All right, welcome back to the Passion for Craft podcast. Today, we are going to roast your house. That's right. No, I'm just kidding. We're going to talk about some design themes and trends that are going on in a lot of houses that Brent sees for his videos, and we're going to talk about why they're not so great. So we are going to, in essence, roast your house, but in a nice way. It's a honey roast, you know? Sweet, but it's...
Yeah, I mean, I'm finding more and more people are asking me, okay, give me a hot take. Give me... You know, I had this guy recently, and I'm not going to use his house as an example because I think he was frustrated. But he paid for a consult, just like, look, something's wrong. I don't know what it is.
Right.
I'm not ready to build this thing. You know, how close are we? You know, and so basically he was trying to build a very traditional house that had wings on the side, and he's trying to manage square footage and all these different things. And I just went through it and just went, well, here's what I'm seeing. And there was probably six things, and all were 2 to 10% things.
What do you mean by that?
Well, like the entry was, he had a steel, really super modern steel door. And I was like, are you trying to, you know, kind of ride that line between contemporary and traditional? No. Well, why do you have a steel door for your front door on a very traditional house? He's like, well, that the architect didn't really, you know, understand what I didn't know how to do it. So I am getting people just wanting a hot take. And so
what do you mean by a hot take is take
in other words, tell me what's wrong with my house.
Okay.
Right. It doesn't surprise me that someone said, okay, I wanted you to roast my house.
Yeah, let me get I want to shout out the person who had the... We're using the idea of one of our patrons who came up with the idea. Name's not listed. I'm so sorry. But thank you for the idea. It says, I have a selfish podcast segment suggestion because I want Brent's opinion on how about a roast my house segment. I'd love to hear him pick apart my McMansion and maybe get his opinion on pre-20s twin.
So what I thought I'd do is just grab some of these Wednesday design videos and just show people what I'm looking at.
Yeah.
And kind of what's wrong, okay? So this first one's a traditional house. And basically, this is a really well-meaning guy who wants a traditional house, and we're actually helping him with a lot of design stuff now and looking forward to helping him build this house. But this was one where he showed me this house and just said, hey, what's wrong?
On the initial, this is pretty traditional.
Yes, very traditional.
Yeah.
He's done.
If he
builds it like that, it will be a big miss, okay? Mm. It will be a... Oops, you know.
A big miss?
Big miss.
Whoa.
Okay, and so the big miss happens because there are, you know, five or six things that he's doing out here. And one of the biggest mistakes I see people making today is casement windows, where there's no business being in casement windows.
You talked about that recently.
Yes, on the podcast I did?
Yeah, on the podcast.
That guy who just showed me his house, the example I was saying, he had a very traditional house and all his windows were casements.
Yeah.
And I was like, is there a reason why you've got casement windows? There is no historic precedent for a American English modeled traditional house to have casement windows. There's not one in America.
Unless it's a first period home.
Yes. So like the Paul Revere house we were looking at had casement windows, right?
A lot of early first period homes were casement.
Yes.
Anything pre-Georgian was casement, most likely.
Correct. I mean, if you figure that the first...
You said there's not one, so I'm giving an example of one. Sorry, just kidding. But I was actually clarifying because I was confused.
No. It's a fair point. Remember that Christopher Wren's Hampton Court Palace in England, 1720 or whenever it was done, had double hung windows in it. Mm-hmm. And it really began this, if you're going to build a good traditional house, it needs to have double hung windows. It started an English tradition and it started an American tradition.
Right.
And so houses after 1740, okay, that are classically, you know, laid out have double hung windows.
Yeah.
And so quit putting casement windows in your house. It drives me nuts. Mm-hmm. And I really think it's a cost and ease function, and they're not thinking about the historic precedent because there isn't an historic precedent. Windows, you know, quite frankly, as we just look at these, is the number one problem that you have. There's this house in Vermont we did. These were the windows, okay?
Yeah.
So they're a cheap aluminum window.
Love that.
That you know, has no trim around it and everything else. And if you just look at this gable end, okay, that this, we had this gable end, which had, you know, double hung windows.
Pork chop ends,
okay, and these double 1/1 windows.
Really high vent up top.
And all I did was separate the window. I put divided lights in. I did a gable end returns, and that this gable end goes from timeless to, you know, to a mobile home, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
All because I changed the windows, I separated the windows, I gave them divided lights, and I changed the gable end return.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very simple, simple things like that.
So simple, like that is a very quick, simple change. Simple financially, how much are we talking here?
Well, if you think about when that house was built,
yeah.
Okay, if they had, instead of going 1/1 windows, had gone to 6/6 window,
yeah,
and had separated it, okay, maybe $50 more a window, okay? And then if you instead of doing the pork chop returns, they'd done a gable end return, maybe it's $200 more in labor, right? And so yes, it's more, but if you haven't built it and you haven't done it and you're just, you know, building it in the first time, it is more, but it's not like thousands and thousands of dollars more.
Okay. I'm changing it today. I want to change it today. How much is that going to cost me?
Well, now you've got to reframe the walls, right? You got to cut in the new openings. You got to, you know, close the thing in. You got to put the siding on.
Yep.
So to move those windows out and put new windows in, let's say the windows are a Goodwin windows, $2,000.
Yeah.
So you got $4,000 in windows and probably another $3,000 or $4,000 in
labor,
framing. And then, you know, another couple thousand in drywall and paint.
It's $10,000.
A little bit less. Yeah, somewhere in there. That's
$8,000 to $10,000. Yeah. But you know, honestly, when you just look at the side to the back to back, it looks night and day, the difference.
It's night and day. And I mean, they did some, they've got a water table on that house, which is good. The siding has a good face and reveal on it.
Mm-hmm.
The windows are really cheap. And here's a, you know, you could spend some time talking about the proportions of the window, but that 3x5 window, that proportion, if you look at the size of these windows, they're probably it's like it's a box. It's like it's, you know, 3 feet wide, you know, three feet tall. And so, because it looks like a box, when it's divided in the middle, you end up with two horizontal rectangles laid on their side, which is a modern deal. Modern is horizontal, classical is vertical. And so you end up with windows that look like they are from the 50s or the 60s or from a ranch period. And changing to divided light and changing the size of those windows really is something that just a few lessons here, you know. Just changing them around.
If
just
take the window as is and you flip it upwards, like up and down, flip it 90 degrees one way or the other, it already looks so much better. Why is that?
Because you're taking that horizontal rectangle and you're lifting it vertical, which lifts your eye, which doesn't accentuate the horizontal, which is what this does. The other thing is that there is a memory or nostalgic view that we have of windows, and when you put double hung windows back to back like that, with no space in between them, that is not something that we remember, okay? Because in the past, pre-1940, because of the weight pockets in a window, there was always a 5-6 inch
gap
separator between the windows where the weights would swing, would go up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have two windows side, you know, paired and jammed back to back like that, it's weird.
Yeah.
It kind of throws you off. And so windows is a huge thing. And, you know, a divided light window, gable end returns, you know, this would be an example of understanding traditionalism, understanding kind of those memories of the past and fixing a good window and it making all the difference in the world.
It really does. It really looks so good.
It's really amazing how small a lot of these changes that I end up making on these houses. For instance, on this, go back to this traditional house, there's this idea called graduated fenestration.
Mm-hmm.
Graduated fenestration is that you have windows that are
smaller
bigger
on the top.
Yeah, smaller on the top, bigger on the bottom. It's a proportional relationship. Now, and if you look at these windows, they're smaller on the top and bigger on the bottom. Why isn't it working? Why doesn't it work?
It's because the windows on the bottom are too long.
Yeah, they're
the
same.
They need to be a little wider.
They're the same width as those windows above, and they should be a little bit wider. The other thing is that there isn't a good precedent for the way they've organized and made these windows. For instance, they've got a really strong lintel stone piece that goes over top and a panel at the bottom.
Yeah.
There's really not a panel in a bottom window like that in the early American period, Georgian or federal period, that was common. He's got a 9 light over 6 light on the lower level. And it's just, you've got this heavier light over this smaller sash.
Yeah.
And it's just off-putting. And it's just like, something's not right. So going back with a traditional 6/6, wider, stronger window, and then doing a smaller window at the top, all of a sudden balances and proportions that out and makes it feel more comfortable, more recognizable, right?
One of the things that's interesting about the graduated fenestration is a lot of times you don't see it in the early periods. It's a lot of period revival that have the graduated fenestration like in a lot more exaggerated ways.
You're basing that on what?
What we learned in class.
I'm staring at Jackson with a perplexed look on his face.
Which makes me think I'm wrong, but I think I'm right. We need to look it up. What we were taught was one of the big identifiers of period revival versus original Georgian federal whatever was the windows on the first floor are much bigger than the window on the second floor.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
I would agree with that. It is more exaggerated or prone.
Because the period of revival, everything was built bigger too. Like,
yes.
Typically, if you have a bigger home,
right,
it's either a really wealthy home in the Georgian or Federal period or
correct
in the period of revival period, it's just a standard home.
Yeah. So in any case, anyway, windows are huge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And if you can get windows right. And the other thing, if you look at this thing, they've got the double hung windows on that first main body.
Yeah.
And then you go to that second body and they go to casements. All of a sudden you got three casements.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to the next body of the building and you've got three double hung 2/2 windows. So you're going from this 6/6 and 9/6 to a 6 light casement to a 2/2 double hung. It's just like,
yeah, it really doesn't look right.
It's one of those things that just kind of throws you and just kind of makes you, you know, makes it odd. Now, the other thing that happens is if you look at just trim details, is that if you look at their pedimented ends, okay, and the way that they're handling the eave details,
mm-hmm,
is the what's drawn on the page. And here's an example of an architect who doesn't know how that should look. They've got basically three lines, okay, which are, you know, if I'm a carpenter looking at this, I'm
talking about these lines or are we talking about these lines?
I'm talking about those lines. I'm talking about those lines.
Okay, yeah.
I'm talking about the all the eave details, okay? It looks like if I was going to build that, and I'm the craftsman building their eaves, I've got 3 1x4s,
mm-hmm,
that I've got kind of stacked on one another.
Right.
Now, that is not how that looks. And so...
And there'll be another page to this with that detail explained, right?
Might.
Really?
Okay, yes. And so realize that in a builder's set of plans, there would not be a detail sheet like that.
Mm.
That you would then be paying more for sections and different things like that that might have that.
So are people guessing on stock lists?
Yeah, I mean, it's not required to, well, in some areas it is, but in a lot of areas, you're not required to have sections and different details of how those elements are built. It's left to the carpenter in the field.
Hmm.
And so, you know, hopefully the carpenter would mock it up. Hopefully there would be a conversation. But if this detail exactly like this gets built, we're in trouble because you're not building a traditional house. And so what I've done is I've the Quinlan Terry, the classical architect, would do these strong bodies of the in the middle that would be made out of a cut stone or a real smooth stone, and then there'd be a rubble stone on either side. Mm-hmm. So there would be a hierarchy of materials, and then there would be you would be stepping down and stepping up. So I haven't really changed the way any of this is put together, but I have, you know, grouped the casements, got rid of those. I have charmed up that little entry there. Even if we keep the windows in this end, I've treated it like a little Greek temple,
right?
So that, you know, you could keep those that window profile, but getting rid of the casements helps kind of pull all this together in a better way.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
You modeled this after the Georgian style, right?
I didn't model it after anything. I am playing with what they've given me.
Like, okay.
They sent me a house that looks Palladian to me.
Yeah. Totally. This looks Federal to me. Georgian to me.
Well, Georgian and Palladian were kind of part of the same period.
Oh, okay.
The strongest Palladian influence was during the Georgian period.
Cool. What tells you it's Palladian versus like a Georgian?
Well, remember the Georgian is a period of time.
Yeah.
So Palladian can be in the Georgian period of time. They're not contradicting each other.
It's like Italianate and Victorian.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Exactly. So you have,
that makes sense. That answers my question.
Yeah. So they're not, you know, against one another. They are, you know, during the same period of time.
I know ovals were typically Federal and semicircles were typically Georgian.
Yeah, the elliptical arch is very common in the Federal period.
So why did you do another elliptical arch here?
Is that an elliptical arch, Jackson?
Yes. Yeah.
No, it's not. It's a segment.
Smaller segment of a circle?
Yeah, it's instead of a pedimented end, it's an arch pediment.
Hmm. Cool. All right, good job. Sorry, I was just confused there for a second. I love the walkway above.
Well, got a walkway on this side. They didn't have it over here, and I'm balancing out the two sides so that they match.
That's a walkway?
Yes.
That's not drawn well.
No, and they used the cable, you know, view rail system.
Which we love.
Which design over that walkout area, and it should be a more traditional balustrade, and so you're balancing it on either side.
Yeah. Well done. Well done. Good job. My student has become the master. Taught him everything I know.
The other thing that happens quite a bit is the other thing that I'm seeing on, and I did this on one of my Wednesday videos, kind of the modern farmhouse critique. And basically what's happening is that we are starting with houses that are like this, okay? Mm-hmm. So they have three gable ends, and I have windows that are all the same. That window's the same, that window's the same, that window's the same, that window's the same, okay? And so you the modern farmhouse was this simplification of the, you know, traditional farmhouse, and that simplification was meant to be kind of clean lined, as we were talking yesterday, kind of anti McMansion. Let's be simple. Let's be clean lined. The problem is it's become really boring.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's becoming where all the materials and all the things match. And here's another example of a cottage style. Okay. With where the architect or the designer has put in all these similar winter patterns. And so now no longer do windows communicate the story of the house because they all look the same.
Right.
And so what I'm doing when I'm fixing these houses is I'm getting, like, this is the garage.
Yeah.
And why you would have a big showy window in a garage, right? I'm just like, why would you do that? Why would you try to elevate that space? So I'm going to dress it down. I'm going to put two smaller windows. I'm going to put a little garden treatment feature in there.
Wait, that's the garage? I thought those were the garage.
They had a four-car garage. They had two this way and two this way.
Ah, I see. Okay, cool. I'm
so there's the floor plan, right?
That's
so
okay.
They had garage this way and garage down this way. And so, you know, this is a workout room. I'm trying not to elevate that. This is a hallway, right? This is a pantry. Mm-hmm. And so I want all the windows to communicate kind of what's happening in those spaces.
Yeah.
We've gotten to a point where, you know, windows everywhere makes the house look bigger than it is or look more showy. It feels like a McMansion trick. It feels like trying to show off more than necessary, trying to make a big show from the street when we don't have to do that. And so I'm dressing it down, trying to, you know, one, communicate that this is a cottage. So I've added leaded glass windows. I've added other things like that. And two, the way they had the materials, they had stone on the garage, stone on this, and then this was all stucco. So it's just like, well, no, this should be, you know, a lesser material. This should be elevated the most, your entry. And it should be the most important materials, the best materials, and everything should step down. So,
okay, out of curiosity, what's with this little swoop design that they decided to go for here? Where's the precedent for that?
It's really popular. It goes back to the period revival. It was very popular in the period revival era. You'll hear it called a cat's back or a cat swoop. It was done very well during the period revival era of the 1920s, when you would have this kind of dramatic swoop. Now,
because I like it here, but I don't like it where they did it.
Really?
Maybe it's just how it was dressed up. Or maybe it was the material that it's done with or something, but there's something about the swoop over here that it...
If I've gotten five of these houses, four of them have had this swoop in them as being the inspiration piece. And so, you know, what this is hearkening back in my mind to is kind of a little English cottage, a little English or European cottage, right?
I normally love.
Right. And the swoop would have been something that would have been, you know, it grew up over time. You know, they had to shed water out over this thing. So instead of building the larger roof, they kind of swooped down to cover up an entry or an area. And so it was something that evolved that looks really natural and pretty and kind of, you know, quaint. And so this person is trying to capture that English cottage feel, but the modern farmhouse infected it so much, it just ended up with a bunch of boring details.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if we're just looking back, you know, backing up globally, not looking at this particular house, we're critiquing these houses, we're critiquing these things, and it's just like, fix your windows, fix your windows, fix your windows.
Yeah.
It's just quit putting big casement windows, keep big walls of casement windows in your house. There isn't a strong precedent for it.
Mm-hmm.
There is a precedent, but it's not a strong precedent. Yeah. And we need to fix this kind of thing.
Okay, I figured it out. Okay. Well, I like yours better than I like theirs. I like yours better because it has a swoop on both edges.
Yes.
So theirs has one side with it where it's straight.
Yeah.
And it leads into this swoop. And I don't love that. And then almost on yours, I would just cut it off at an even height to the other one, to where it's like one swooped gable right there, and then like a lower archway just down below separately.
Yeah, I mean, what I try to do on these Wednesday design videos is people send me their house, and I'm assuming that they've got the floor plan ironed out. Most people, that's the first thing they do when they design a house. We want this. They don't start, I've described it before, they design their houses from the inside out, whereas historically we were always designing our houses from the outside in.
Right.
And so I'm assuming that they have spent a lot of time trying to fix their houses.
How they're going
to
be.
How they're going to lay out, where the kids' bathrooms go, where the mudroom is, where all those different things are. So I'm not, well, we got to move this over to the other side,
right?
And just, I'm just trying to fix it with the architectural elements so that it looks right.
Yeah. Which makes a harder challenge, I'm sure.
Maybe
easier. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, in some respects, it's easier because I don't have to rearrange their. Well, your exercise room doesn't make any sense over there. I'm going to move it to the right. I don't want to get into all that.
Yeah, totally.
So
that's a little out of your wheelhouse too, because they could be like, I wake up every morning.
We spent all our time talking about this thing, and it's just like no.
Yeah, that makes sense. Wow, really interesting. I also love the vibe of this home.
You do?
Yeah. Especially with the
leaded glass.
Leaded glass windows.
Dude, I mean, I feel good. Like, you know, half of the opportunity here is to evoke those charming things, be a student of the past. Why are those period revival houses of the 20s and 30s so charming?
Mm-hmm.
Why do I drive through Park Hill and Berkeley and some of these different areas that have period revival houses and go, it's just, what is it? Well, it's the scale of them. They're not very big houses, right?
Love that.
And so these houses that are, 5,000 square feet and want to be a cottage, that can be a challenge, right? That's hard to do because the scale of those houses over there in the 20s and 30s is 2,000 square feet. 2,500 square feet is big.
Yeah.
The average size house in 1920 was like 1,500 square feet. And so, those are bigger houses. And so part of the challenge today when people are building 4,000 and 5,000 square foot houses and still want a cottage is making it a cottage, right? Making it have that stuff. Being a student of the way they did their stone and the trim, how they handled timbers, where the leaded glass went, the way lighting, landscaping. And so being a student of the past helps, make those houses so much better.
Yeah. It really does.
Okay, so if we're just going back, the big thing is windows. The next thing would be trying to establish a hierarchy of materials and helping people figure out which materials go where. And so
hierarchy matters across the board, right? You got to have hierarchy. Like, you can't have columns that are on the second level that are bigger than columns on the first level. You can't have windows on the second level that are bigger than windows on the first level. You can't have materials, it sounds like. Like, you can't put wood as your bottom layer and then stone as your top layer.
Right.
It would just feel wrong. Hierarchy has to be.
Yeah. And so, but then what it comes down to is, and I always tell people, it's narrative, right? Telling that story really well. If you do the things you just described, if the bigger columns are on the top than the bottom, you're not telling the story very well. You're not communicating clearly. It's a confusing story. You're like, wait, why is that heavy material above the weak material?
And you're not necessarily saying those words. You're more just like, what's going on here?
It'd be like if there was a glass box, okay, and then over top of what was this heavy, monolithic, brutalist architecture.
Right.
You'd be like, I'm not afraid to go in there. It looks like it's going to fall down on that thing, right?
It might
break on me. And so that's an extreme example, but I think there's other examples that even looking at this little cottage house, this house doesn't know what it wants to be. It's trying to communicate, but you are looking at it with more questions than you are with answers,
right?
Like, okay, why, where, what's important? What's dominant? I can see that there's kind of a front door there, but
I wouldn't have been able to tell you that was a front door unless you said it was a front door. I think you putting the coining on the front door made it better. Is it still called coining whenever it goes over? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And so, it just...
Because it's like a flashing light. It's like, hey, come in.
Right.
Come
it's here. Inviting.
Yeah.
And so this one, you read and you're just like, you stand there kind of looking at it going, okay, what am I supposed to do here? How am I supposed to react? Where am I supposed to go?
Yeah.
And so it's confusing, right?
There was a house by the K-Life house that had this same thing where it was like, it had the swoop. And so I was like, oh. Because I was like, I've never seen this before. I've never seen it on like any big white stuccoed houses, and that's what it was.
It was a disconnect.
It was like, what is this? But if it was on like a old brick or old stone house, I'd be a little bit more like, oh yeah, of course. That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean,
And then the front door didn't make any sense.
Right. So again, I guess I say that second thing, and it's really should have maybe been the first thing, is that you're trying to craft a story or a narrative that is believable, that is inviting, that where the characters like if you remember back to Harry Potter, and reading Harry Potter, and remember you know, the uproar, you know, about the wizards and all that other stuff. The fact is that she created characters that were so compelling, mm-hmm. that were so interesting, that were so unique, that were so different from, and she created a world that was like, was crazy inventive and everything else. And so Harry Potter was an engaging hero, right? Mm-hmm. Just like she created a narrative that was, you know, believable. We, when we're building our houses, are trying to create a narrative that's a believable, that's attractive, that's charming, that's inviting. How do you do that? Well, all of these little things, getting the windows right, right? A hierarchy of materials.
Right.
But then the other piece of it is creating a believable story that's based on tradition would be the Brent Hull thing.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, if this house, 4,000 square feet, was really built in England, you know, or in Europe 200 years ago or 300 years ago, it never would have been built that big, right? It would have been, there would have been a main body of a house, an original structure that was probably the best built. And then as the family grew and the thing, you'd have these additions and these other pieces that have been added to it that would have been, you know, that would have been natural and appropriate because all the materials would come from that same region. The roof pitches would have had to deal with the same kind of snow loads and everything else, so they wouldn't have changed that. But they might have done some addition. Hey, we just need a quick addition. It's cheaper and faster. And so it wouldn't have the same quality of stonework.
Uh-huh.
And so there would be this natural progression that you could look at and be invited into. Whereas when the hierarchy of material is wrong, it's just like, wait, why is the garage the most important element on this on this thing? That's a secondary structure. That was never part of kind of the main body. And yet here it is front and center being shown off as the most important piece. Like, why is that?
Yeah.
And what I did is when I worked on this, I dressed it down. I gave the, you know, I clipped the gable end so that, that it wasn't as strong. I took out the quality of the windows. Yeah. I lowered the windows and I have, there's less lights in these one, or there's more lights in these windows because bigger pieces of glass was more expensive.
Yeah.
A outbuilding or a secondary building would have very small pieces of glass because you wouldn't have had, it wouldn't have been as important. And so, you know, I had to raise up the peak of that story because it was secondary to the garage.
Right.
I actually lowered the garage and raised the middle one so that it's the strongest one.
Yeah.
And so little subtle things like that are the thing that make it attractive and
yeah. One of the things that we've just learned so much is you have to think through every step of the process. And I don't know if the architect is thinking through every step of the process. It doesn't look like they are given some of these things. Like the idea that like, and historical context helps because it provides a framework for you to go, how would this have worked, right? Because if it was a 4,000, 5,000 square foot house back then, that's a mansion.
Yep.
That's an estate. Yep. That would have been more of like,
materials would have been better.
It would have been, but the style would have been different. It wouldn't be a cottage style. So that almost doesn't communicate like the grandioseness that you're needing it to. And then on top of that, if you take a look at this first picture of like the, without you drawing on it, and you think through the details, right? Like in practice, if someone drives by my house in the at like dusk, whenever the lights around are dark, they can still see my house. But then if my lights are on inside, they can see inside really well. They're going to see a car sitting right here.
I know.
It's going to be dark and there's a very visible car. They're going to see an unused workout room going on right there. Or someone jogging who doesn't really want to be seen right then and there. You know what I mean? Like those are little things. But then also you're also like, wait, do I want them to see me jogging right now? Do I want them to see me? Yeah. Do I want them to see me in my pantry getting my fourth Oreo of the day? I don't know. But you know what I'm saying? Like that, those are things where you're like, oh, it'd be better if they didn't see that and they saw my entryway or my front room where I've got all this nice furniture set out. That's what I want people to see whenever they peek into my house, not the other. But that takes so much foresight to be able to sit down and go, all right, what room is this?
I actually don't think it takes that much foresight. I think I wonder at like a plan like this, how we ended up with five windows like this all in the front of the house.
Mm-hmm. All metal windows.
Yeah. Well, they're drawn as metal. I think they're wood or clad or you know, something. And I sit there and go, it almost feels to me like it's lazy. It feels to me like, okay, well, here's what it is.
Yeah.
They spent so much time, you know, laying out the floor plan that they were just like, well, now what do you want? Well, we need something traditional. I'd like a cottage. Okay, good. Here's your cottage. And it's just like, no, wait. And so it feels lazy to me. That feels lazy to me.
I remember when you showed me this first and you were like, look at this one. And I was like, I don't know necessarily. I don't get it yet. I'm not understanding it. And then you drew on it. It was like, oh, I get it. I see it, which I know is common sentiment with your design videos. A lot of people are like, I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't see it.
And then they draw it and then you're like, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That's right. That's not right. Whatever. You were telling me today about the spa you're designing or helping design someone's spa in their house or whatever. But you're on a website or something and there's a snow room for someone to have snow inside their house.
So we've got a client in Dallas that we're building a house for, restoring a house for, and he really wants a spa space and a spa room.
And everyone knows a good spa needs a snow room.
And so he didn't want just any spa. He wants cold plunge, hot plunge, sauna, you know, all these different things.
The works.
And so we're now kind of, who do you go to? Who's your spa guy, right? And so it's not like you have. And so our architect, our lead designer, she reached out to some of her contacts, and they're like, well, there's a spa consultant down in Austin, and this is all he does. And so they sent us his brochure, and basically his brochure has all these things, and one of them is a snow room. Okay, and I'll read you the description of it.
Does this guy want a snow room?
I don't think
that's a shame. That'd be so cool if you sold him on a snow room in the thing. The picture of it's hilarious, by the way. The picture of it is literally a guy standing there, and it's like a spotlight's coming down from him, and there's clearly snow drifting into this room. And I don't know, in case you need to go stand in a snowstorm for your spa treatment.
I'm going to pull it up here. Yeah, the snow room was done so in a way so that they were talking about a hydrothermal journey, a design for leisure.
Amen.
Okay? So they've got saunas and steam rooms. Of course, everybody has that. The hum-hums and hum-hams.
Hum-hums.
Hammams
and hammam.
This company has created award-winning hammams.
Let me see it.
Including
Hammams. Hammams.
And what is that?
Hammams.
Okay, hammams. One for this famous hotel. Traditional hammam, whether Turkish or Moroccan in style, is considered a place for cleansing. These steamy rooms will often include a heated belly stone as a centerpiece where attendants scrub and clean bathers. This can also take place in the private smaller hammam treating room. In a communal hammam, basins called kurnas are available for washing and rinsing, and there'll be plenty of bench space for bathers to await treatment or to simply relax and socialize. So there's relaxation spaces, rain and drench experiences, cold plunges, cold rooms. A cold room offers a refreshing counterpoint to heat therapy. Typically maintained at temperatures just above freezing, these rooms can be empty or house a plunge pool, ice bath, snow shower.
How big of a room are we talking here?
Well, I mean, that looks like, you know, 12 by 15.
Yeah.
And so
that's a room.
The purpose of the space is to stimulate circulation, provide a full thermal contrast experience. Snow showers. Okay.
This is crazy.
The sensation of melting snow on the skin is another alternative for bathers looking to cool down after a hot cycle.
That's why you want it. You want the snow.
Snow
to melt
showers are either open or closed areas where a continuous snowfall can be generated by a push of a button.
Have we gone too far?
I said no new products except this one. The benefit of modern snowfall technology is that snow can be produced regardless of a room's ambient temperature. Freezing temperatures are not required.
What?
Cold therapy snow brooms. Okay, that was a snow shower.
Wait, hold on. Freezing temperatures are not required.
That's what it says. The snow room is a modern alternative. It's considered a gentler option to the shock that comes from plunging into icy waters after a hot sauna or steam room.
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong. That's why you want the cold plunge.
Advances in refrigeration technology mean that it's now possible to replicate the traditional role in the snow in any hydrothermal facility. Snow rooms offer another benefit. Snow simply makes people happy, bringing out their playful inner child.
We're going to go have a snow fight in the snow room. Snowball fight in the snow room.
So there's a snow room that they've got.
Oh, my gosh. That's a different one than the one you showed me. Yeah, the snowfall room or whatever. Yeah, that is crazy.
So yeah.
What's the craziest thing you've ever put in someone's home? I mean, and don't get me wrong. I would love every one of those things, like that would be, it's crazy, but it would be so fun designed, to be able to experience that.
We designed a bowling alley, but never put one in.
Okay.
Because
there's a lot of these stuff where it's like, I would never want it in my own home, but also it's pretty cool when someone else has it, you know?
We put a shooting range in a house.
Wait, what do you mean a shooting range?
Like where you go shoot your pistol and
Are
stuff
you
like
serious?
That. Yeah.
That's cool. Sorry, I thought you meant skeet shooting at first, and I got really excited.
No, I mean we're not
Have
really
you ever done a basketball court.
Yep, done half courts. Yeah,
half court.
Yeah, done those.
Have you ever done like theater room? That's pretty classic.
Theater rooms, done those.
What are some like nice
a
features
slide,
of them?
A slide. People wanted a slide
no
in
way.
The house.
I think that'd be cool. Have you ever been back like after 10 years on
no.
those houses?
Because
that I'm always curious. Like, do you still use it? You know, you got a slide.
The people
you
that put in their court, that put in their basketball court, they still use that quite
yeah,
a bit.
That one makes sense. You'd put it in if you liked a ball, you know?
Yeah. But they use it as a mini sport court and everything else.
Of course. Yeah.
Golf simulators, obviously put those in.
That's a big one right now.
Yeah. That's a hot one right now.
Did you see Dude Perfect's new facility?
Uh-uh.
It's pretty crazy. It's mainly just big and it's like sport court city. So they've got like a basketball court. They've got like a putting green. They've got on their basketball court, they have moving baskets. So they've got the,
oh, really?
it's a full court. But then on the sidewall, it's like there's one where it's rotating in a circle.
Oh, that's fun.
One that goes up and down, one that does a diagonal or whatever. Those are pretty cool. They have the shooting range too. Not the shooting range, the driving range.
Driving range.
That's crazy.
Put safe rooms in before.
What does that look like? Because I'm always curious about those.
Bulletproof walls.
Mm-hmm. Is that hard to install?
No. It comes in sheets. There's companies that Armor Core and stuff like that that
so
make.
So you just do sheet, like 8 or 9 of these? Like
no, you don't
sheets?
Have to do that many. I mean, there are different sheets for different, you know, calibers of guns and things like that.
So they're bulletproof rooms.
Yeah.
Are they like break-in proof too? Like, is it hard to get through them?
Include a metal door and stuff like that. And
have you seen some of the, I'm asking a lot of questions, but you know, the movies sometimes when they have like a safe wall or a safe door, they don't do the walls. They cheap out on the walls. And so the hero will kick in the wall next door and it's just drywall.
I haven't seen that.
It's pretty funny.
We've done some things where you press a button or you type in a thing or you move a book.
Yeah.
And you, like we did that one on that show.
We did that one on the show. That was cool.
Where you touch the snake's head.
Yeah.
And then I had one where it was, you pulled a book and the safe door opened up.
How well did that one work?
Pretty well.
Pretty well.
Yeah.
The Magnalock I wasn't as impressed with.
Yeah.
Because there was too much of a delay.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Uh-huh.
So you press the snake. Because the snake head looked beautiful.
Yeah.
It's just
we had
hard
one
to wire
that was
that
actually
thing.
On a motorized thing that opened and closed it. And that was slow. Elevators, obviously, we've done those.
What's the craziest request you've ever gotten? Like, would you ever do that?
A GIMP room. No, I'm kidding. I have a GIMP. Will you put a hookup on those? I don't know. I mean, I can't think of something that would be weird.
Yeah. I just meant like crazy, like wild request.
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, what would be a wild request?
I don't know. I feel like secret passages and stuff like that, like those are always cool. I know you did one for your parents for that house.
Yeah.
It was like it was almost like it was like a bookshelf was a door almost. Right.
And then
that's cool.
Yeah. We did I feel like we do that a lot.
I've seen those designed a lot. I would love to make one of those. And they're not hard.
Yeah.
It's just manipulating drywall, it feels like.
Well, you're having to you're figuring out where you're going to hinge the bookshelf because you've got a really thick wall that has to move,
mm-hmm.
and then that swing path causes some challenges.
Right. Well, thanks for watching this episode of the Passion for Craft podcast, and we'll see you in the next one.